All right. Yeah, Rebecca was born ready. Oh, Bud was born ready. Good morning. I'd like to call the House Education Committee to order. Today is April 15th. Let the record reflect the time is 8 a.m. Today we have present Representative McKay, Representative Prox, Representative Himshute, myself, Co-Chair Ruffridge. I'd like to remind committee members and those in the audience, which is no one this morning, to silence or turn off your cell phones. Staff assisting us today, Linda with House Records and Susan with the LIO. Thank you for being here today. And Mr. Sexton will be the committee aide today, and he is available should you need anything. This morning we have two items on the agenda. First up will be a presentation from the Alaska Excel program. This is a presentation I've been very excited about, and I'm really happy that you guys were able to be here. I know it's taken a little bit of effort to get this to happen. And I'd also like to note for the record, we are joined by Co-Chair Allard at 8:01 a.m. Well, without any further introductions, please, I guess, give us your introductions, so your names for the record, and then please begin your presentation. And I think for committee members, we will try to hold questions until the end and let them make it through their presentation. So keep note of what you have for questions, and we'll have time for that at the end. I've scheduled about an hour for this presentation. Go ahead.
Great. For the record, Jamie Clays, Alaska Excel Aviation Program Manager and Public Relations. Thank you for having us here today.
For the record, Crystal Wilson, CFO for Alaska Excel. Thank you for having us.
For the record, Nillian Smith, former Alaska Excel student currently employed at a small taxi called Spernex.
For the record, Noah Oleron, former student and current staff at Alaska Excel.
Welcome. Well, thank you guys for being here today.
Great. We really appreciate your time today. So I've been working with Alaska Excel for the past it'll be 6 years now. And I grew up in rural Alaska in the Yukon-Koyukuk School District and attended school there. In a fly-in-only community. So very passionate about the work we're doing for rural students and excited to show you guys a little bit more about our program if you haven't heard of us yet. Being from rural and having attended school in the Yukon-Koyukuk, I've yet to see a program do what we're doing, and that's why it's so important that you guys have us here today. And again, thank you. So to give you a little background before we get started, Alaska Excel is an educational nonprofit. It was formed about 10 years ago. We're doing our 10-year anniversary this year. And we're located on the APU campus, so the Alaska Pacific University campus in Anchorage. It was formed and created by two school teachers that were out in rural and saw the need. So they wanted to do more and create a program to make education equitable in rural, to provide services for rural Alaskans that they didn't currently have. We serve 7th through 12th graders and also that summer after their graduation. So our demographic is 7th through 12th in rural Alaska. We partner with school districts so that we're pulling students out of their classes for intensives, but we are not a boarding school. So they come in for intensives to do trainings, and then they go back to their school district. So they're still counted in their borough and their district. And we found that to be really effective. So we're not a boarding school, we're an intensive session. And just click away here.
Yep.
There we go. All right. So established in 2012, and we are rapidly growing. In 2014, we served only 16 students with four school districts. In 2015, we served 375 students, eight school districts. Fast forward to 2023, 677 students, 12 school districts. We are accredited, so we have high school credits that they're earning during these classes. So a lot of our students do need those credits to graduate on time. 440 industry certificates. We're partnered with industry, including myself. I'm a pilot by trade. I used to fly medevac, and now I teach and have my own aviation company that is contracted by Alaska Excel. So we have professional aviators and certified flight instructors teaching the aviation programs similar to the other programs we do, whether it would be construction or the hairdressing strand. We have certified industry partners that are teaching those, not school teachers. And then in 2024, we're slated to serve just over 900 students. We're pretty maxed out because the need is so great right now. So our last session was the biggest ever with 90 students. Every single bed was full. So Noah could speak to that since he's a dorm parent. And so you can see that the need is getting bigger than we can fulfill in our current space. One thing I like to point out too, which is really important to me, is that the program is not an awards program. This is for all students. And so we don't, it's not GPA based. In fact, if we have students that are shut down or not engaged, we ask school teachers and districts to send them because we are trying, that's the whole point of our program is education for life. We really want to spark the student to find out what they're going to do after high school. And for a lot of our rural students, that's not a four-year degree. For some of them, it is. We do offer different strands for that, such as education, if they want to become a school teacher, or if they want to do the four-year degree for aviation. But if they want to go straight to work out of high school, we also want to provide them the support to do that. And so we serve all ability levels, and they're all together. They're not separated out by their cognitive function or their ability. And so we like to say that we serve all the students. And that's a really important part of our program because there are a lot of awards programs out there for rural students, which leaves the other large behind. You can see on here that the total rural Alaskan students served over the last 10 years is 2,434. The high school credits earned, industry certificates, and the Excel session completion rate is 98.5%, which is really high because we provide a lot of mentorship. So during our sessions, we have a lot of coaching. If a student's having a problem in a class, we put them on a coaching plan. So then they have additional support and they meet with an instructor or staff member to go over why they're having a difficult time. And we try to coach them through that rather than just send them home because they're maybe having an attitude problem, right? As well as if they're having substance abuse issues, which we have a lot of, unfortunately, in the state. If they're having withdrawals from nicotine, things like that, we actually provide, we have substance abuse counselors on staff so that they can continue learning and we can put them with someone that can help them through that. So that's part of the reason our session completion rate is so high, is that we provide the tools to meet them at the door wherever they're at. And then we've increased the graduation rates in the areas that we work in. And because we do federal native federal grants, we actually have to track those. And so we have a lot of data that we have compiled over the last 10 years. And we've increased those graduation rates 88% for Excel concentrators. And concentrators are a student who's attended two or more sessions. This is just an infographic of basically what we just talked about. You can see the state of Alaska is the map of where we serve, the yellow portions. We do have school districts in the other regions that would like to partner with us, but we are pretty maxed out on space right now. So we've had talks with the Nana region, and we actually are going to be serving students from Huna and at one point Yakutat.
Sorry. For the record, Krista Wilson. We really have three pillars to Alaska Excel. Originally, when we started, we came from a model similar with Chugach School District. It was called the Voyage to Excellence Program. It was back in the early 2000s when the Reinventing Schools model was going through the state. There were performance-based school districts across the state. And so the foundational sessions were really developed with the state standards in mind for career development and personal social skills. Chugach School District at the time was kind of leading the pack in performance-based education. And so students came into those sessions and learned career development, personal social skills. They got to go on job tours, work on budgeting, those sorts of things that all counted towards their high school graduation. Career development at that time was weighted the same as English, science, mathematics in that system. Since then, most of the school districts, Cusbuck School District, I think BSSD School District, they were all in those performance-based model systems. They have since exited and gone back to the Carnegie system. I think Chugach School District is the only system or the only school district that's still in the performance-based school system. But our foundational sessions were really started in that model. Students start in seventh grade. And they come in and learn educational skills, leadership skills. It's usually their first time away from home. So there's it's 4 days, including travel, super quick. They come in, they get out of their comfort zone. They learn to meet new people. A lot of our students come from areas where maybe their school site is just meeting kid count. They have 10 students pre-K through 12. Maybe they're the only student in high school in their school. And so coming into these sessions and now being with 80 other students that are in seventh grade or eighth grade is a big adjustment for them. And it starts to kind of spin those wheels and for them to start to think of the possibilities either within their community or outside of their community. A lot of our students in those first two sessions, they learn important skills like communication, eye contact, resiliency, motivation, those sorts of things. Each session builds on the curriculum builds, but you're not required to start in seventh grade and go all the way through. We might have a student that joins us in 12th grade, and that's the very first time that we've seen the student, and that's okay as well. In seventh and eighth grade, it really focuses on leadership. As they transition into ninth grade, students start to learn about career pathways. They go on interactive job shadows in Anchorage. They start to learn about this idea that you're going to have a career when you graduate from high school, and what might that career look like for you. They learn a little bit about budgeting, and then also we start to introduce them to healthy lifestyles and talk briefly about suicide prevention and drug and alcohol awareness and those things that are affecting them in their communities. In 10th grade, we transition to industry. So students come in, the session is longer. Students start learning about industry across Alaska. They go on tours and check out the courthouse, the law enforcement industry. They go to the unions and look at those industries. They go to healthcare and look at that industry. We also work with Alaska Career Information Systems, the ACE-KCIS platform, and students, every single one of our students has a portfolio on that system, where they take, assessments that help connect them to careers that their skills match, their work values match, and that they're excited about. And then from that system, it also connects them to colleges or post-secondary opportunities that offer the training that they need to get the career that they want. In Excel 10, we definitely dive deeper into budgeting. Students learn about, they learn how to ride the bus. They do mock interviews. They purchase interview outfits on a small budget. They go to the grocery store and do comparison shopping so they can see the differences between grocery stores and how much that could save them as they transition. And so a little bit about budgeting, because some of our students in rural Alaska, 80% of the population that we serve is on government assistance. And so it's a different world out there. And so to be successful in the urban setting, if they choose to move, they have to understand how to budget. And so that's a big piece of what we do. In Excel 11, we focus on post-secondary. And this is by design that we do this in the 11th grade. Students come in, they take their AKC or they take their Access not Access, Alex assessment, sorry, which is tied to the university. It's the math assessment, entrance level assessment for the university. They also take their ACCUPLACER, which is the reading assessment and English assessment for the university. They take their ASVAB or their practice ASVAB if they're interested in the military. They take their TABE assessment if they're interested in AVTECH. And really it's to see if there's educational gaps between what they want to do. They say they want to go to college and be a teacher. Okay, well, you need to get into English 111. Right now you're scoring basic English language learner. Okay, here's the gaps. You know this in 11th grade, so the students have a chance to turn this around while they're still in high school if they choose to go on to the university. They go on campus tours. We take them down to KPC. They tour APU, obviously, because that's where we're at. They tour UAA. We go down to AVTECH. They get a chance to check that out. And then also Job Corps, which, in all honesty, Job Corps is one of the most successful places that our students end up transitioning to, because they provide some wraparound services after they graduate from high school, and they provide training opportunities, and they really meet the students at the door. We continue to work on suicide prevention, drug and alcohol awareness. We have two clinicians on staff that work with students. We also dive more into budgeting. And then as students transition into 12th grade, the Excel 12 is very individualized. So we meet the students at the door. If a student wants to go to college, then we have them apply. Alaska Excel pays for all college application fees. They apply for the colleges they want to apply for. We help them fill out college scholarships. Most of our students are Alaska Native, and so their regional corporations usually have scholarship applications that they can fill out, so we help them complete all of those. We help them through their FAFSA, which is a big hurdle for a lot of our students, so we help them get through that. And really, we want them to open up as many doors as they can in their 12th grade year. So let's open up the Job Corps application. Let's do you're thinking UAA. Okay, let's get the application done. Let's get it so that you're set to go to UAA if you want to after you graduate. You think you want to get a job? Okay, let's get your resume and cover letter set so that you're ready. Let's practice interview skills. Let's do those sorts of things so that you're fully ready to transition after you graduate from high school. So I'm going to show you a brief video. Maybe. On our foundational sessions.
The coolest thing that I got to learn was how to apply for
colleges and scholarships.
The coolest thing is opening my first bank account. How to adjust for an interview.
Doing the job interviews.
Self-defense.
I accomplished many things. I got my driver's license. I applied for Job Corps.
It's been a busy week and learning what to do after high school. Yeah.
I found out that I actually love teaching and helping others.
This has given me a foundation for life after high school.
Before I came here, I was really, my mind was blank on what I wanted to do. And it's really good, they get you out of your comfort zone. Trying out something new is fun, you know? It's giving me a foundation for a better life.
This is giving me a foundation for learning new things and what I gotta do when I'm out of school.
A foundation for making best friends and getting along with your roommates.
A foundation for my future.
This is giving me a foundation for the ability to learn and push for my dreams.
This has given me a foundation for success.
From our foundational sessions, students then have the opportunity to apply for our career pathway sessions. Students have to complete a foundational session to be eligible for our career pathway sessions, and that's where students have a chance to dive into construction trades, photography, heavy equipment, medical, cosmetology, piloting, aviation mechanics, public safety, education, and then we also have a credit recovery session for English and math. I'm going to have Nellyanne introduce herself, and she's going to talk to you a little bit about the career pathway that she went into, and then introduce a video as well.
For the record, Nellyanne Smith, with the help, or In English, that means with the help of Alaska Excel, I have become the first woman pilot from my home village. I am currently instrument rated and private pilot working on my commercial license. Alaska Excel provided me the tools and support for me to pursue my dream to become a pilot. I want to inspire other students, especially Native women, to pursue their dreams too. I took two introduction to aviation classes in high school, as well as month-long summer Excel camp. The classes are what made me believe it was possible to be a pilot. Here's a video of an introduction aviation maintenance.
I want to be a mechanic so I can help not just my town but anywhere else that I'm at.
This was my first time in mechanics. I've learned a lot.
I decided to pick this course to become a more well-rounded aviation pilot. If you broke down or got stuck somewhere, it's good to know how to work on your plane.
I can have a secure future and Excel helps me with that.
I would recommend it because once you get into it, you like learn more and more. It's really interesting and it's pretty fun.
I could see myself working as an AAP mechanic and as a pilot.
It'd be awesome for me to see me in the skies or down here working on an engine.
I learned the details about how engines work. In the small town of Pointo, there's a lot of engines to work on, and it would be good to know how to fix them, just to support the community.
Our career pathways, there are, we offer three separate sessions. We offer a fall CTE session, which is introduction to that career pathway. We offer a spring session, which is the intermediate, and then we offer a summer session, which is a month-long session. All of both the foundational and the career pathways are all tied to high school credits. For our career pathways, like Jamie had mentioned, we have industry that's instructing our career pathways. So we partner with, or post-secondary, so we partner with training outfits such as Northern Industrial Training. They're the ones that deliver our heavy equipment, our carpentry, our welding. We are going down to Kenai Peninsula College this summer for our month-long camp, where KPC will be teaching our first responders courses and our welding courses, as well as small engine mechanics. And then ACC is going to be instructing behavioral health for students. Jamie will be down instructing aviation and aviation mechanics. And then we also have a partnership with retired troopers that are going to be instructing our law enforcement strand down there as well. From there, students can that are in high or in their 12th grade year and graduate can then transition into our internship programs. And Noah here went through our internship program, and he's going to talk a little bit about that.
For the record, Noah, I am from CHIVAC with the help of Alaska Excel programs. I am currently a private pilot with an instrument rating. working to complete my commercial pilot's license. I work as a dorm parent at Alaska Excel and as a ramper at FedEx. These programs have changed my life and a lot of other rural students too. I attended the internship program for piloting, working part-time with the local air taxi while flight training. Here we will play a video showing the piloting internship program.
I love everything about that. It's always been my dream since I was 10, 9 years old. I wanted to do the aviation class because ever since I was a little kid, I was like looking at the planes flying over the village.
We've been flying, learning about charting courses, weight balance, the components of lift, flying. It just feels so cool.
It's really nice getting to feel the controls of the plane and how it feels, because you learn a lot better at the controls than you do just studying by books, and so getting to feel that feels really amazing.
Excel is a great opportunity for me to reach my goals and accomplish my future.
Definitely do it, because it'll definitely help.
It's real fun flying.
To be in the air, you have all the views.
It is amazing.
For the record, Jamie Clays. So the internship program is a super important part of it because for a lot of our students, it's the first time they're putting a job on their resume out of high school. So, I have two aviation students here with us today. We clearly do a lot more than aviation, but because I'm the aviation program manager, these are the two students that came with. So the way it's set up is that the students have a job at a local air taxi for aviation, or depending on their strand and what they've chosen. And they'll actually work at that local air taxi after they graduate, anywhere from 10 to 20 hours a week alongside their internship, either as a aviation mechanic, logging hours in a logbook, or doing their flight training. This provides a huge network for them to start really on the job skills. Alongside that mentorship of coaching of, we have a very strong partnership with the industry partners. So if the student needs additional coaching on showing up on time, right, there's an understanding that this is their first time we're in having a job. And so it's incredibly important that we have these partnerships with industry. And it's something that we've actually been published in ICER articles as the industry standard for that, because no one else is doing it like Alaska Excel with our industry partners, really trying to work to solve the problem for workforce development in general, as far as getting workers, Alaskan workers, into these jobs. So a huge part of that is the internship and the industry partnership to get them that first job on their resume, to get them real life job skills right away out of high school. For instance, Noah was working last summer at Talkeetna Air Taxi while gaining more hours towards his commercial license. And he was our dorm parent up there, where we have a house in Talkeetna where students are all working at the small local air taxis while they're doing their flight training or their maintenance. So that part of the program is super important for the transition out of high school, which we plan to build upon as well. So our Alaska Excel alumni, we actually did a survey recently, and some of you we've met with individually, and gone over these numbers, but we did a survey on the alumni, and 80% were working in a career cluster, 12% in college, trade schools, or military currently, and 8% were not working. Something we assumed but didn't know for sure was that most of our Alaska Excel alumni are remaining in Alaska, and the ones that were not, who we contacted and were able to get a hold of, were either in military or in school and had plans to come back. So a vast majority of our rural students are staying here and working here, which I think compared to urban is probably a large gap. And 70% of our students that we were able to get a hold of and contact for the survey are living in rural Alaska currently, possibly a bigger hub community or a nearby village, maybe not the village they grew up in. And 68% are still living a subsistence lifestyle. Again, for the workforce development piece of this, this is why industry, including the aviation industry, since that's the one I'm a part of, really believes so strongly in the Alaska Excel program, is because we need Alaskans to fill these jobs. And rural Alaskans aren't leaving. They want to stay here, work here, have their families here. And so that's a huge benefit to all of Alaska.
For the record, Krista Wilson. So currently, our challenges that we're facing is that our student waitlists are exceeding about 30%. On the Alaska Pacific University campus, we are located in the South Atwood building, which is traditionally a dormitory. And currently, we have 84 beds. That building, I think, is considered a historic building, and the plumbing with 84 students in there is troublesome, to say the least. Our current growth rate since we're coming out of COVID is about 20% a year. Last year, we served 677 students, and this year, we're almost up to 900 by the time we get through all of our programs. Our program does operate year-round, so students... We have summer programs going on, like the Summer Excel Camp that I mentioned. We will be down in Kenai Peninsula College for that one, but we do operate year-round. We have additional rural school districts that are wanting to send students to our program that see the benefits. We've had Nana Region reach out, wanting to figure out how to get districts out there to those students to our program. We've also had students or districts in Southeast Alaska, such as Huna and Yakutat, reach out to figure out how to get their students engaged in our program. Right now, we cannot bring on any additional districts at a large capacity because we are at our max with our current district partners. Currently, we have 13 school district partners spread across the state of Alaska, with the majority of them in the interior region, and then we have the Chulista region that we serve, and then North Slope Borough School District as well. Currently, our agreement with APU, we have a long-term six-year lease agreement with them that is coming up in 2025. We are able to extend the lease agreement on a year-by-year basis, but they have stated that there's no room for expansion for our program on their campus. So until we figure out how to get into our own building or onto our own campus, we are at capacity with the number of students that we can serve from rural Alaska. Additionally, students, what we have found is that our rural students really need an extra year to 2 years of transitional support to be fully successful when transitioning out of high school into the workforce or into an urban setting. And so with this project, we are proposing building a transition dorm to offer wraparound services for our recent high school graduates. We have submitted a project this year into CAPSIS for a Alaska Excel campus. That would allow us, we've located a building out in Palmer Wasilla area. It's an existing charter school. The charter school that's in it, which is Birch Tree Charter School, is planning to move out and build. They have land allotted for them, and they are in the process of figuring out how to build their own building. And so that building, the timing for that building to be vacant really lines up with our proposed timeline for building our own campus. It would increase our capacity if we were able to pull this off. It will increase our capacity by about 44% for our 7th through 12th grade students. This will allow us to equip students with the essential workplace skills that they need to succeed in today's world. It will also help increase educational equity for our rural Alaskan students. A lot of our students, like I mentioned earlier, we do have students that come in from very small villages that are maybe meeting, you know, barely meeting kid count. They might have one to two teachers in their entire school building teaching all content areas 7 through 12 or 6 through 12, all content areas pre-K through 5th. There's no way that that student can get the same education or opportunities that a student in Anchorage School District, Fairbanks School District, you know, down in Kenai Peninsula area. There's not the opportunities there. Alaska Excel really helps to close the gap in that equity by allowing students to come in and get take elective courses, find out a career pathway that they're interested in, maybe do welding, do carpentry, go into education, do EMS, whatever it is that they're passionate about. Without this program, there's not a lot of opportunities out there for our rural students that are in these smaller districts. And then lastly, for the transitional students, we are proposing in this project to build a transition dorm that would sleep 75 students to help them, give them support services, wraparound services to help them fully transition from high school into whatever they're wanting to do. One of our main partners for industry certifications is Northern Industrial Training. They are located out in Palmer. They do not have housing, which is a big hurdle for our students wanting to go to NIT. There's no housing available. There's no transportation available. They do offer a hotel out there, but that's not an ideal situation for a young 18-year-old coming from rural Alaska. So this transition building would really help students get the skills that they need to pursue the careers that they want. We have been working with RIM Architects, and they have done a schematic design for us. This is what the potential building could look like. It is Birch Tree Charter School. The entire project is in CAPSIS, so if you're interested or want to see the entire project in its entirety with the full layout with the schematic design, you can look at it on there. We don't have it at this presentation. This is an aerial view of the proposed campus. We are proposing doing this project in four phases. The project that we submitted to CAPSIS is for $15 million over the 5 years, with $6 million in the first year to help us purchase the building and land. It sits on about 14 acres of land, and the building itself is about 44,000 square feet. That is figure one on this page. Figure two on the page is the dormitory, 150-bed dormitory for our existing 7th through 12th grade students for our existing program. This would allow us to expand to other districts across the state of Alaska that are interested and continue to serve the students that are on wait lists currently in the district partners that we do have. Phase three of this, the building, while it is designed to be a school, it does not have a cafeteria, so we would have to renovate the building and put in a cafeteria, so that is phase three on this proposed project. And then phase four is the transition dorm, which is proposed to be 75 beds. This sits on the Palmer-Wasilla Highway, and it's directly across from the MTA Sports Complex, which has five courts. It's also about 5 miles down the road from Northern Industrial Training, which is, again, one of our main post-secondary partners. The budget for this project, in the pre-development and design phase, purchasing the land and the building, we are looking to raise about just under $11 million. You can see the breakdown there. The purchase of the building is the majority of that budget. Construction in 2025, the construction is of the 150-bed dormitory. We are proposing doing it in this order because at the time, Birch Tree Charter School will still be in the building. We would take over the lease and lease back to them because they are needing an extension so that they have more time to get into their building. But this would allow us to construct the dorm building without interrupting their school day. The third phase of this project would be the remodel of the existing building and adding that cafeteria. And then the fourth would be the transition dorm. This is how we have planned to raise the funds. We know that this is a very large project, and we need to bring multiple stakeholders to the table to make this a possibility. We have very strong partnerships with our regional corporations, Chilista, Doyon, and ASRC, and have already met with all of them. We have gotten a commitment from Chilista to this capital campaign. We also are going to all of our industry partners that we work with and asking for their support in this. And then we did submit to CAPSIS for that $15 million with $6 million in the first year. We have also been down to D.C. to meet with Lisa Murkowski for federal earmark appropriations, as well as our foundations. We have submitted applications to the Denali Commission. Rasmussen is not putting out an application this year, but we do have the Denali Commission submitted. And then we are also reaching out to Matsu Health Foundation and Alaska Mental Health Trust, and then funding from our live campaign. And that is it for our presentation. Any questions?
All right. Thank you very much. I saw lots of furious note-taking, so I'm sure there will be questions. Before we get to those, we have about maybe 20 minutes or so for question and answer. I do need to note for the record that we were joined by Representative Story and Representative McCormick at 8:04 a.m. Also wanted to note for the record that Noah has the nicest suit that I've seen all year. So thank you for being well-dressed. All right, questions? Representative Prox.
Yes, there was a court decision Friday, I think it was, came out that apparently we can't fund private schools. Is this a private school? How does that figure into this court decision?
Let me see if I can get this right. Through the chair, Representative Prox, Krista Wilson. We are a 501c3 nonprofit that serves public school students. We do have one of our district partners is Yukon Koyukuk School District. They do have Raven Correspondence, which is a statewide correspondence program. And so we have served homeschool students through their program, but that gets routed through their district. I am not sure if the district then turns around and charges the parents an allotment for the student to come to us. I don't think that's what they do, because they do have federal funding that pays for their students that are from Nulato or Minto to come in and attend our program. So, yeah, we were made aware of, or I did see what happened on Friday. As far as Alaska Excel goes, the decision doesn't affect us in that way because we don't serve a lot of homeschool students.
Mm-hmm. Follow up,
please.
And then I guess through the chair, getting reminded of this.
Okay.
The operating funds, how do you charge tuition, or how does the operating part of this work so that it's an ongoing enterprise?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Prox, the majority of our funding is federal funds. We have the ANEP grants, Alaska Native Education grants, that we go after every single year, and we're pretty good at getting them. So the majority of our school districts get written into those grants. If we have a school district that joins and maybe we're mid-grant cycle and they're not written into one of our federal grants, then we do have a fee-for-service system where we can charge the district fee-for-service. We are working currently with DEED to align all of our courses, all of our CTE courses to Perkins. So every single course will be articulated through Perkins and into their CTEPs, which allows our district partners to use Perkins funding to send students to us. The skin in the game that the district partners have is travel. Travel is very expensive to get students from rural into Anchorage and back. Sometimes students have to take, you know, Noah flies from Chivac on a hopper plane, gets to Bethel, and then from Bethel into Anchorage. And so those airfares are pricey, and that's usually our smaller districts use their Perkins funds to send students, you know, as travel funds to send students because our coursework is Perkins articulated. But the majority of our funding is federal. We also have multiple industry partners, ConocoPhillips, Donlin Gold, Ryanair. They all donate to our program to help make sure that there's zero cost to the students when they come to us and zero cost to their family.
Thank you.
Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, I have a number of questions. My first one has to do with the supports you're providing for kids who struggle. So you said you have on-site substance abuse counseling. Do you have career counseling, mental health counseling, or is it one person doing all of it? And what's your ratio on that?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot. We have two clinicians on staff that we've recently been able to bring on because our federal funding has increased. They help primarily with substance abuse and mental health issues. A lot of our students do come in and are, especially since COVID, have addiction issues, whether it's ICMIC, tobacco, something harder than that. And so, you know, we're an educational entity. They can't do that while they're with us. And so those clinicians are there to help them through there. We are, all of our staff is trained in ACEs and being aware of meeting students at the door. So we have, the way our program works, our staff are all trained to be career counselors. We call them instructors. And then we do have the mental health counselor piece that is on there as well. They do take, you know, some of our students onto, I guess, what would be considered a caseload for our mental health counselors. But they're there to support all students, even if they don't need actual counseling after they leave the session. Some of our students do require that when they go home, that additional support. It's nice that we have that because a lot of our students in our smaller communities, their auntie might be the mental health clinician in their community. And so they're not willing to go open up to their aunt about their issues that they're dealing with. Whereas somebody at Alaska Excel, who they've seen multiple times, they built up this trust. Now they can actually receive some valuable services that they need.
Hello. Thank you. Through the chair, where all do you have program sites? You mentioned Talkeetna, you've got APU. Do you have other locations?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, we have, so we're on APU campus. In the summertime, we do travel to different campuses across Alaska to give students a taste of that college campus. So last year we were on Avtech. We partner with them. We were down there for a month. This year we'll be at Kenai Peninsula College, staying in the dorms at Alaska Christian College and partnering with them. So they'll be there for a month. We have a hangar located on Merrill Field for our aviation program for aviation mechanics and piloting. And that's part of Alaska Excel. And then we have Jamie Clace with Swoop Aviation has a house out in Talkeetna where she does the internship program. That is not Alaska Excel. It's Alaska Excel through our industry partner, Jamie. Swoop Aviation.
Thanks. Through the chair, this idea of an extended bridge program for the first year or two of transition into a post-secondary program, how do you determine who's eligible for that? And like it seems like something we've needed in the state for a very long time. So is it open to anyone, or they have to have been rooted in your program to kind of earn a spot in that when you have it? I know you don't have it yet, but when you do.
Through the chair, Representative Henshute, we have a month-long transition program that we're operating right now because that's all that we have space and capacity for. We operate it out of Alaska Pacific University, and students, we provide them with services, help them figure out public transportation, help them figure out getting into the dorms if that's what they're wanting to do at UAA or APU. We help. They do work internships with Alaska Native Heritage Museum. So that's what we're doing right now. Those students are prior Alaska Excel students. I think ideally in our model, there would have to be some sort of vetting process to have students, because it would be on the same campus as 7th through 12th grade students, and then having young adults on the same campus with them, not in the same building, but on the same campus. Ideally, they would be Alaska Excel alumni that would be in that program.
Thanks. Could you, I think you addressed this already, but I think it's worth hearing again. Why do students need that support?
Through the chair, Representative Henshute, students need that support because what we're finding is our high school grads, we help them get into the door outside of Job Corps, because Job Corps does an excellent job of providing wraparound services for students that attend Job Corps. But if students don't want to go to Job Corps and they want to go straight into the workforce, or they want to go to the university, or they want to go to NIT, what we're finding is that transition from rural into urban is very tough. Trying to find an apartment on their own, or maybe they move into town and all of a sudden they're living with a cousin and they're staying on the couch and it's not a healthy living environment for them. The majority of our students that end up at UAA, unfortunately, in about the first semester, end up dropping out. And it's not because they're not capable of being there. It's because they don't have the support services to help them stay on track, manage their time, stay away from alcohol, all of those things. They're in the dorms with other students that are, you know, doing what students do.
Follow up. At one point, the completion rate at UA for Alaska Native students was as low as 7%. And I think you're talking about exactly what the supports are that would change that. So could you go over a little bit? You said your staff have training. Since you're serving a K-12 population, there are mandatory in-services that are required for certified teachers. I'm curious how many staff you have and if you are subject to these mandatory in-services, or how you determine what the baseline trainings are that they need.
Through the chair, Representative Henshute, we have roughly 30 full-time and part-time staff members. We have three, including myself, that are certified principals or administrators. We also have six certified teachers on staff, and then two certified clinicians on staff. Some of our staff, though, we have staff that we've hired that were prior students and have gone through our training and to learn how to deliver curriculum, be motivational, and deliver the career development. We do have certified teachers of record on staff to honor the credits. We have not gotten state funding in any capacity. And so because we've been able to manage under a nonprofit, we have not been bound to any of the state mandates as far as mandatory in-services or anything like that. The districts do honor our credits. So we issue the transcript. The district then can decide if they're going to honor the credit or not. All of our districts do honor our credit because everyone wants their students to graduate on time. And they know that when the students are in town, the seat time matches up. There are certified teachers on staff and certified administrators on staff. And so we've never had an issue with districts not honoring our credit. Our instructors go through 1,500 hours of training. We are currently working with ICAS out in North Slope Borough in developing a apprenticeship model for educators. And so that would take them through the 1,500 hours worth of training that we give our instructors before they're on their own in front of students.
One last follow-up. Thank you, through the chair. My last question is for Noah or Nellie Ann or both. What are your plans?
For the record, Nellie Ann Smith, through the chair. I'm planning on becoming a certified flight instructor and working for Jamie. So I have about 3 more trainings to go, and I've been helping them. So,
through the chair, Noah, Representative Hemshoot, I'm planning on getting my commercial pilot's license, multi-engine rating, and a certified flight instructor to help with students. And then I also plan on maybe working for cargo out in Western Alaska to fly stuff for where I am where I'm from.
Thank you.
Representative Prongs.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. This Excel, Alaska Excel, is its own entity. Who or which organizations are on your board?
Through the chair, Representative Prax. Our board, through the ANEP grant, we are required to have an 80% Alaska Native board, which we do. We have our board chair is Colin Stewart from AvTech. We also have representatives on our board from ASRC, from Chulista region, or from the Chulistan Corporation, and from Doyon Corporation. I think we have 11 members on our board currently.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge, and welcome. Very excellent presentation and very exciting what you're doing. Thank you. And the sky's the limit for both of you, and that's really great to know your careers are well set. One of the questions I had, just on confusing on the PowerPoint to me, and you can perhaps explain it. It says in 2024, 900 service students projected. And then on the next slide, it says total rural served 2,434. I was just wondering why the different numbers there.
Through the chair, are you a representative or a senator? Yeah, Representative Story? Okay. Oh, yeah. Sorry. The 2,400 roughly number is total students served since 2010. The 900 projected is this year, and that the 2,400 does not include this year's numbers on there.
Follow up? Thank you for that. And I really think it's just critical that you guys are collecting all this data. And so do you have a data person who does this, or all of you as part of career guides are required to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Story. We have a data bank platform that we work with, where we plug everything into when students come into our program. The data that we collected for our graduates, that was a team effort to really reach out and collect all of that data. We do partner with ICER, and they do some data collection for us, as well as our David Tarsi with Alaska Research. He is our evaluator for our federal education grants, and so he does a lot of data collection. We have memorandums of agreement in place with all of our rural districts that allow us, that through that agreement, they agree to provide us with student data that we need, graduation rates and that sort of thing, absenteeism, dropout rates, that sort of thing, when it comes to the students that we serve from their districts.
Thank you. 2 more questions, please.
please.
Yes, the first one has to do with the FAFSA. You talked about having your students complete that and how that can be challenging. What kind of completion rate do you have?
Through the chair, Representative Story, we have students that want to fill out the FAFSA. I would say, and I don't have exact hard numbers on this, I would say close to 60, 70% once we sit down with them and work through it. It is a very hard application for a lot of our students. The main, just navigating the platform itself and having to set up the FSA ID and all of that is challenging, but we sit down and what we tell them is this application, oftentimes with our students, is worth about a $6,000 Pale Grant. So if you can suffer through 2 hours for $6,000, let's get this done. So we sit down and we really help them. The biggest hiccup are when we can't fully finish it is when we can't, either their parents didn't file taxes for the prior year, or they don't want to give us the information that we need to enter in for the taxes. A lot of times we're on the phone with the parent while the student's sitting there and we're getting all of the information, birth dates and socials and whatever we need to fill in on the FAFSA so that they can get it completed.
Thank you for that. And then last question, TVAP funds, are you eligible for TVAP?
Through the chair, Representative Story, we are eligible for TVAP. We've tried to get TVAP. We've tried to get in the door with TVAP. TVAP is pretty coveted.
So thank you.
All right.
Chair Ruffridge.
Yeah, just a quick time check. I have a couple of questions myself. So in the districts that you serve, are you in a contract with those districts for a certain number of students, or how does that work?
Through the chair, So in the memorandum of agreement, we do, based on the number of students that they have and the number of slots that we can serve in each, because there's 13 different districts, and at capacity, we have 84 beds. So that's, you can kind of do the math with the number of slots that we can offer to each district. Districts submit their applications. So we have a student services person on our end that works with student services people on the district end. They gather all the applications. The districts pick the students that come to us. We go out and we do presentations and we get students excited, but at the end of the day, it's up to the district on whether they're going to send, who they're going to send and how they choose, what their criteria is for sending students. The different student number, for instance, LKSD is probably our largest district that we serve student population-wise, and so they do end up getting the majority of the slots. In the memorandum, it does have a minimum that the district's supposed to try to meet, because at the end of the day, when we're writing these grants, the federal grants, we have student numbers that we're putting into the federal grants on what, the numbers that we're going to serve. And so if a district runs out of funding and all of a sudden isn't sending students, then it makes it hard to meet those federal numbers. And so, but for the most part, right now, I think Cusbuck School District might be the only district that has said that have ran out of travel funding to be able to send students. And so they may not meet the minimum that they had said they were going to, but it's not necessarily a deal breaker on our end for that.
So each district essentially allots a certain amount of funds for students to come to the program each year?
Yes, for travel only. All of our grants pay for all of everything else. So once they're with us, all of our program is covered through our federal grants or industry partners or donations that we have. Districts pay their student travel. Usually they're using Perkins funds, and so they've set aside or they've allocated their Perkins funding for student travel. Because in our smaller districts, like Cusbuck School District, for instance, their Perkins allotment is maybe $21,000, the minimum of whatever the Perkins allotment is. Well, they can get a lot more. The students can get a lot more services for that $21,000 by spending, $300 one way or $600 round trip for each student to come into Anchorage and get career and technical training than they can to maybe buy some equipment or pay part of a shop teacher's salary at one site when they have 5 sites out there.
Okay. Well, thank you. I do want to make sure we are giving time to take up the bill that we have in front of us. Is there any further comments or questions from committee members? Representative Allard.
Thank you. Can you remind me again how many students attend annually?
Co-Chair Allard, this year we're slated to have about 900 students through our door annually.
Thank you.
Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Really quickly, through the chair, the new FAFSA that just rolled out is supposed to be faster. Has that been your experience? And I know that you're having to work with families at home and get confidential information and that kind of thing, but is the form itself?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, no, it's not faster. It's I think they've made it more secure. You have to go in and you have to get your FSA ID, and then from your FSA ID, you log back in. And you use a save key to get in and continue. I think it's probably once you get through the initial piece, reapplying year after year is probably faster. But that initial application, the issues that we have are the issues no matter how the application is. And really, it's around making sure that the parents' taxes are filed and that we're logging in correctly. And then a lot of, you know, some of the issues in rural, a lot of our students have P.O. boxes. They don't have physical addresses on your taxes. You have to put a physical address or a P.O. box, and you have to match it. And so when the system goes from FAFSA over to the IRS system, if you don't match the address correctly, it kicks it back and then kind of kicks you out of the system. And so there's some issues there. But the platform itself is about the same.
Final question. Thanks. Through the chair, are you eligible for residential school support? You said you're not getting any state funding right now. Would you be eligible for that since you're not a residential program? The funds for residential schools may not apply to you. Have you explored that?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, we have not explored that. I know when we were first figuring out the path that we wanted to go for Alaska Excel, we had talked about the idea of being a variable term program. It puts a lot more restrictions on what we can do if we go down that route, and so we didn't go down that route.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being here today. It was a pleasure to take up this presentation today, and thank you for providing that information. Welcome to Juneau. To you all, please get out and enjoy the sunshine, which is a real blessing today. We will take a brief at ease while we transition to House Bill 202. Thank you again for being here. Brief at ease. We are back on record, House Education Committee. It's time to take up House Bill number 202 once again. Representative Johnson, thank you for being here. We do have her available staff, Savea Bieber, thank you for being here. And also online, we do have Teresa Welton with the Department of Health and Kelly Manning, the Deputy Director for the Innovation and Education Excellence Division of the Department of Education. The amendment deadline for House Bill 202, which is dealing with opioid overdose drugs in schools, was on Wednesday, on April 10th. We did receive 8 amendments, and so it is my intention to take those up today and see where we end up. Is there any brief introductory comments, Representative Johnson, that you have for us before we begin taking up amendments?
Thanks for having us here, and I look forward to addressing the amendments. Other than that, I can't think of anything additional. I'm not sure if my staff has any additional comments. I'm not sure.
All right, I think we're good. Okay, well, we will start going through these, I guess, one at a time. So before us is amendment number one. This is one that I am offering I guess, myself, so I will offer amendment number one.
I will object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Representative Story. Amendment number one simply adjusts the language of the bill. Every time it mentions a naloxone nasal spray, inserts instead an opioid overdose drug. And this is the best way, in my opinion, to ensure that if there is some other sort of opioid reversal agent besides naloxone that would like to be used, that this bill would not prohibit that from happening. In addition, it does delete the definition of naloxone nasal spray on page 2, starting lines 22 through 24, because we're adjusting that language accordingly. So, Representative Hemshue.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. I think I have a question for the Department of Health, if they're available.
They are. We have Ms. Manning online.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Ms. Manning, we were told that there's a 15-minute video already available. Is the video specific to a nasal spray, or does the video cover more signs and symptoms of when a medication is needed and the various ways that you can intervene in an overdose situation?
Good morning. For the record, this is Kelly Manning with the Department of Education, Division of Innovation and Education Excellence, and we do have a course on our e-learning platform at the Department of Health or Department of Ed, and it was developed in partnership with the Department of Health. It includes both the administration of the opioid overdose reversal spray, as well as the signs and symptoms that you would watch for. In addition, there's a longer course available in our e-learning that goes into more depth into opioids and opioid prevention and misuse prevention.
Please follow up.
Thank you, through the chair. This is sort of a side question, but is that video approximately 15 minutes long?
Yes, correct. Through the chair, this is Kelly Manning. Correct, it is about 15 minutes long.
Thank you.
Representative Promise.
Yes, thank you. I think things are easy to do when it's an idea, but more difficult when it becomes a law. This possibly opioid overdose drug is a lot broader than a specific application, and just thinking down the road, could this authorize something that requires a lot of training to administer and commit school districts to hiring or training somebody almost medically trained? I don't know.
Was that a question for me, Rich?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is broader language. Certainly, I think the intention would be to not name a specific medication, i.e. naloxone is a specific medication. There are other reversal agents that can be administered. Naloxone certainly is the most common and the most easily used at the moment. However, you know, not that long ago, naloxone nasal spray wasn't even an option. If you were overdosing, you would have to be admitted to the emergency room for more significant care. And so I think that the intent is to ensure that a specific named drug isn't preventing other named entities from being administered at some point. I think some of the other language in the bill sort of indicates that it does need to be somewhat easily used. I wouldn't envision, a IV bag and things, available for longer term infusion therapy or anything like that. But the intent is to be available in an emergent situation.
And if I might follow up on that sentence, and administered by, if you will, a civilian as opposed to someone specially trained.
correct.
Right.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. And this is to Ms. Manning with the Department of Health. Through the chair, Ms. Manning, this proposed amendment, do you see that this would right now mean to you naloxone with the school districts, and this doesn't, does this change have any concerns for you?
Good morning, through the chair, Representative Story. Again, this is Kelly Manning with the Department of Education. With that adjustment, we would continue to use our course as it's written because it would still meet that requirement. It would allow us the flexibility if there was a more readily available or a shift in recommendations to make adjustments to the recommendations in the course and in documentation. And we would work closely with the Department of Health in any revisions or adjustments based off of health guidance.
Follow-up.
Thank you for that. And follow-up through the sponsor of the bill. I'm just wondering to know if they are comfortable with this proposed amendment.
Representative yes. Johnson.
Yes, this is considered a friendly amendment.
Thank you.
Okay, any other discussion on this? Do you maintain your objection, Representative Stone?
No.
Okay, is there any further objection? Hearing none, amendment number one has been adopted. Moving on to amendment number two, from myself, I will offer amendment number two.
For purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Representative Allard. Amendment number two essentially inserts a new subsection. After a committee discussion, there was some concern that a school district or individual may be liable for damages if there was a failure to either possess or maintain naloxone spray under this section. I'm now just recognizing that with this First Amendment, that will probably need to be changed as well under technical and conforming changes to opioid overdose drug, but this is a section to render someone not liable should they have a failure. Representative Allen.
Thank you, and I appreciate you bringing this forward, Representative Ruffridge. Could you explain maybe how this wouldn't, or I don't want it to impact the kids. And so I'm trying to wrap my head around, this isn't pertaining to them giving the spray, is it? Or are you including them in this amendment?
Representative Allard, yeah. So I think this does specifically reference an individual as well. So okay. An individual would not be liable for damages for injury to another individual. And I think that would pertain to all individuals, including children, should they be administering an opioid overdose drug. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Administering is not currently in the language that I can see. Does the word administering need to be added?
Representative Prox.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, thank you. On page 1, line 7, the word administer. Right. That's the first time it's used. Representative Allard.
Thank you. I'm not sure who's going to answer this question. So a little bit of my concern is, one, are we going to be giving the children the video to watch? And then for me, I would hesitate. I would want my child to opt out of administering a drug. I think it could be traumatizing for them to be in that situation. I have teen girls, and it's a lot right now of everything that they're trying to handle through social media. And I was trying to figure out, can this amendment lead into, I think I'm just worried that the kids are getting too exposed. So if they see someone on the ground, are we going to hold them responsible for not having it? Are they going to be taking video classes? Or my daughter's never seen someone overdose on a video, and I'm not really keen on showing it to maybe a 13 or 14 year old kid. So I don't know how they're going to get training on it. I'm trying to see if that's relevant to this. It might be relevant to another one. I want to be super cautious of what kids are exposed to unnecessarily.
Through the chair, Representative Allard.
I'm gonna let the sponsor, I think, respond first, if that's okay.
And then, sure. Okay. So I think the intent is for this to be a school district component, not a requirement that students take the education, although I will say that the education that Ms. Manning was referencing it is available online to everyone, but it would have to be your choice to go find it. This would be the district itself, not a student being required to do this. That being said, I think this amendment does actually prohibit in the case of a person who does not feel trained, choosing to not engage in an emergency situation, but just, you know, going to call for help or something like that, this section would eliminate their liability from not offering assistance, which actually does correspond to other state law about good Samaritans just in general. But Ms. Bieber?
And based off that, I can wrap my head around it. I just don't want a 14-year-old. Yeah.
Yes.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, the one thing I would add to that is this amendment is specifically for an injury resulting from failure to possess and maintain. So I wouldn't really say that has to do with the kids possessing and maintaining. I do see where you're coming from, though.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other discussion on amendment number 2, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, excuse me, I haven't had enough time to really look this through and think about it, but it occurs to me that we should add administer in this new section. I'm just trying to think of how personal injury lawyers look at things. And if we've said that this commissioner of health shall provide school district training video and how and when to administer, then C becomes another section. And they aren't liable for not having it or maintaining it, but they still, if administer isn't in section, the new section C, I would guess that a lawyer would look at that as, golly, they can be held liable for administering it. Or, and not naloxone, it's the broader language that we have already adopted by Amendment 1. So, I guess I move a conceptual amendment to Amendment 2 to add a comma after possess, delete the word O, add a comma after maintain, and add the word administer.
And I will object.
Okay.
I'll object to that, Representative Prox, for one specific reason. The intent of this amendment is actually to clarify that should someone go to essentially a box on the wall or the nurse's office and say, expect to have a opioid overdose drug on hand, and that box is empty,
mm-hmm.
that school district or school itself would not be liable for the empty box. Other law already protects individuals from their liability for choosing to either administer or not administer the opioid drug, and that is what we reference as a Good Samaritan law, which is state law already. So although I understand the intent to try to clarify that, I don't think adding the word administer in this instance is entirely necessary, but I'll let the sponsor of the amendment or of the bill maybe weigh in on that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking about, you know, if you add the administer, just add administer in a string of words. I think the, like you say, the Good Samaritan law should cover all the possessing and administer, not possessing. I mean, if you're required to possess and you don't, that's what this is covering. But if you don't administer, you can't force someone to do that, or you can't force someone to have liability for it. But you know more about the Good Samaritan. Savannah knows more about the Good Samaritan law than I do. She may have something to add to that.
Through the chair, I don't really have anything to add. I would just echo the comments of Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. Other discussion, Representative Allard?
I don't think it would hurt to add the word administered, so I'd actually support this conceptual amendment to amendment number 2.
Thank you, Representative Allard. Other discussion points on conceptual amendment 1 to amendment 2? All right, seeing none, I will maintain my objection. If you could please call the roll. Did you have a comment? No. Okay. Please.
Representative Crocks?
Yes.
Representative McCormick?
No.
Representative McKay?
No.
Representative Hinshue?
No.
Representative Story?
No.
Co-chair Allard?
Yes.
Co-chair Ruffridge?
No.
2 yeas, 5 nays.
All right, so with a vote of 2 yeas and 5 nays, conceptual amendment 1 to amendment 2 has not been adopted, which brings us to amendment number 2. Any further discussion on amendment number 2? Seeing none, Co-Chair Allard, do you maintain your objection?
No, I withdraw my objection.
Okay, with that objection withdrawn, is there any further objection? Seeing none, amendment number 2 has been adopted. This brings us to amendment number 3. By myself, I will offer amendment number 3.
And I will object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Representative Allard. Amendment number 3 is, again, in response to some of the committee discussion and testimony. This simply removes the language dealing with school buses. Representative McCormick.
Thank you, through the chair, Chair Ruffridge. Can you just help me understand why we should remove this language? I guess I'm just not really sure why we shouldn't have it on school buses.
Thank you, Representative McCormick. I actually tend to agree with you significantly. One of the bigger issues is the fact that school busing is a contractual arrangement with districts. And so a district having the requirement would actually potentially increase whatever that contractual arrangement would be to require drivers to either be trained or maintain a naloxone spray or some sort of opioid drug. The other issue is that naloxone spray, as that is the item that's available now, actually is not... should not be stored under freezing temperatures. And so as it is incredibly cold in many of the parts of this state, the spray sitting out in a bus, it would have to be brought back and forth or maintained on a person close to them to maintain its warmth. So there's some practicality aspects to it. I don't think that this language in here would prevent a school bus driver from having it, but a requirement that they have it seemed like it was a little impractical. Follow up.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge, through the chair. I think I'm going to be in opposition to this amendment. Amendment number 1 changed naloxone nasal spray to an opioid overdose drug, so I would think perhaps if there's issue with the nasal spray, school district could instead employ an overdose drug that can withstand some of these cold temperatures. I just think cost-benefit analysis, if there's an opportunity to save a life, we might as well have that in place. So I think I'm going to go ahead and object to this amendment, and I think we should leave this language in here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McCormick. Other discussion questions? Representative Hemshue?
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. I have a similar amendment that I was going to offer for exactly the same reasons. And what I was playing with is there some sort of language we could add that would encourage districts to encourage their contractors? And I decided not to attempt to do that, but I have the same thoughts as Representative McCormick. I wish we could keep it in, but I see the reasons for not keeping it in, and I just hope that individual contractors will put in place policy so that drivers are equipped.
Thank you, Representative Hampshire. Other comments, questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, I consider this a friendly amendment, but I also would like this to not have to do this. And so one of the things that I looked at is if you do have a bus that, I don't know about many of the bus, so I didn't have a chance to look at every one of the school districts. That's one of the reasons I'm in support of the amendment, because there's all these different ways that different contractors deal with the bus service. But many of the places, if not, I can't say all because I didn't have a chance to do the research on this, but many of the places, even if the buses themselves are not in a bus barn, if they're outside, the drivers come in and they have a locker and they pick up their first aid kits or whatever it is that they're kind of basically the bag that goes onto the bus. They don't leave those on the bus overnight. The drivers do have a place that they store them inside. But since I did not have a chance to look at all the different school districts and how they might deal with that, I am in support of this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Story?
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. And I, too, am in support of this amendment, but I really think it's important that we work to make sure school districts have in their contracts that they start renegotiating with the school bus drivers, that they bring this up. And I was wondering, at some point if this committee might want to write a letter to, I don't know if it's the Alaska Council of School Administrators to speak to their principals or their school boards, actually, maybe that's what it should be when they do their contracts. But I definitely think we should try and take some action because it is really important. When I'm agreeing with this amendment, I'm thinking of the testimony from our superintendents at our last committee meeting and the difficulties that this might bring, even though difficulties, we need to get through them because it is so important, as everyone's talking about.
Thank you, Representative Story. All right, seeing no further discussion, Representative Allard, do you maintain your objection?
I do maintain my objection.
Thank you, Representative Allard. If you could please call the roll.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative McCormick.
No.
Representative McCain.
Yes.
Representative Hinshu.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Co-Chair Allen.
Yes.
Co-Chair Rutherford.
Yes.
6 yeas, 1 nay.
And so with a vote of 6 yeas and 1 nay, amendment number 3 has been adopted. I will not be offering amendment number 4. Amendment number 5 from Representative Hinshu.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. I move amendment 5.
And I will object since I think we might have just passed amendment number 5.
Oh, sorry. I'm not paying attention. Let me get to my own notes. I guess I'm not offering amendment number 5. Correct.
You,
not offering number 5.
Which brings us to amendment number 6.
Chair Ruffridge, I move amendment 6.
Thank you. I will object for discussion.
So somewhat regretfully, I offer this amendment because I love the idea of not making another mandate on districts. This is at least the fourth unfunded mandate that we're looking at this session. At the same time, to really comply, having one or two people trained in a building, there's any given day where those one or two people may not be there. And so it made sense to me, knowing that the training is short and it's one time in a person's career, either for existing personnel, they would, under this amendment, take the training at the beginning of next school year, And everyone else, when they become employed with the district, would take the training. So it's not something they have to do every year, but it's a one-time 15-minute commitment. And I'm uncomfortable saying we need everybody to do it, but I think if we want this to be effective, we need everybody to do it. So that way the district will always be in compliance with the statute, but more importantly, everyone will know what to do when the time comes that they need to do it.
I object.
Representative Howitt?
Thank you. I think this is something that the school district can handle, who they want to designate. I don't think it's should be a requirement. We already have teachers that are overloaded with duties, and I think just adding this is a lot. And some teachers, frankly, probably don't want to do it. And I wouldn't say teachers. I'm going to say government employees, because the building is full of government employees. So for me, I would leave this for the administration to decide.
Thank you, Representative Allard. Other comments or questions for the bill sponsor? Did you have anything you wanted to add, Representative Johnson? Amendment number six. Okay. All right. I will say I do have some concerns regarding amendment number six myself. In the fact that although I think these videos, having watched them, are useful, I have actually the same concerns as the amendment sponsor, which is requiring another set of things for someone to accomplish, again, without any sort of means by which to accomplish that. In addition, thank you for the field trip to the bill sponsor. I think we were made aware of the box that we have just down the hall here, and the ease by which you can access that and administer that. In an emergency situation, it has a step-by-step instruction. And so although a video being watched would be probably useful and helpful, requiring it for everyone may be a step too far at this moment. So I will be in opposition to Amendment 6. Representative McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Didn't we just hear that it's just a 15-minute video?
I believe that was the testimony from Ms. Manning, but we could ask her again if you'd like.
Yes, please.
Ms. Manning, if you'd like to give us a brief description of the video, training video from the department.
Yes, good morning again for the record. This is Kelly Manning with the Department of Education and Early Development. Through the chair, Representative Prox, the course that we have available in our e-learning platform is 15 minutes long and covers both the signs of an opioid overdose and the administration of an effective opioid overdose reversal drug. It is brief, relatively quick. We would revisit if there was any edits that would need to be made based off of the statutory requirements if this bill were passed.
Thank you. Did you have any follow-up to that?
Thank you.
I do have a question for you, Ms. Manning. Do you keep any data on number of times an e-learning segment is viewed or accessed?
Yes, for the record, this is Kelly Manning, Representative Ruffridge. We do keep records, and I can provide that as a follow-up of how many times that course has been viewed, and we can give some current, like in recent, and then over time. So I'll provide both of those as a follow-up.
Thank you. If you could send that to my office and we can distribute that to the committee, that would be appreciated. Other comments or questions from committee members? Representative Story.
Yes. Question is to Rep. Hemshute if she talked to other districts about that. And then also I am, well, actually I'll let her answer that first.
Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, Rep. Story. I didn't. However, I want to clarify, although the amendment is on page 2, it's addressing something on page 1. And on page 1, it says on line 7, actually on line 5, each school district shall ensure that, and then on line 7, a person trained to administer naloxone nasal spray is on site on line 8 when the main school building of each school in the school district is open to students, staff, or the public, etc. My concern, so even though the amendment is on page 2, is that for a school district to ensure that every building at every time it's open has a person on site The only practical way to do that is to make sure that all staff are trained. So I think I went a little astray from your question, Rep Story, but I did not reach out to individual districts on this question. I just was drawing on my experience and thinking, how would we have exactly that right one person who's been trained in the building at all times? And it's just not practical.
Follow up?
Based on that information, I'm offering a conceptual amendment, 1 to number 6, and it would be after require, the department to require, adding the words "to the extent practicable." Whoops, does that work? The department. Yeah, to the extent practicable, to the extent practical that each individual is employed by a full-time. So those are the words, to the extent practical that.
Thank you. I will object. Representative McKay.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, I don't think you can have language like that in a state law with such uncertainty associated with it.
I actually tend to agree with Representative McKay. However, we put it in a lot of state laws, which essentially makes them not all that effective. So that is the reason for my objection as well, Representative McKay. Other discussion or comments on conceptual amendment 1? Representative Story.
Yes, the reason that I do that is, as Rep. Hemshut had said, it is a mandate, and I don't know all the ins and outs of each district. And so I put that there, as we do put in other laws when we just have such a unique delivery situation in Alaska, and not all districts are very unique. So
thank you, Representative Story. Is there any further discussion on conceptual amendment 1 to amendment number 6? Representative Story.
Yes, so what does the bill sponsor think of that amendment, the conceptual amendment?
I think it pretty much, I think it's going to, there's no, as far as I can tell, there's no way to identify what those words really mean. So to the event practical ends up being kind of guts the amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I will maintain my objection to amendment number 1 to amendment number 6. If you could, did you have input? I'm sorry. Every time you touch your microphone, I got you. Okay. Please call the roll. Thank you.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative McCormick.
Yes.
Representative McKay.
No.
Representative Hemshut.
Yes.
Co-chair Allard is not present. Co-chair Ruffridge.
No.
That is 4 yeas, 2 nays.
All right. And with a vote of 4 yeas and 2 nays, conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 6 has been adopted. Amendment number 6 now reads, the department shall require to the extent possible that each individual who is employed full time, and then goes from there. So any further discussion on amendment number 6? Three. All right, we are back online. I apologize, I made a mistake. Amendment number 6 now reads, the department shall require to the extent practicable that each individual. So I apologize for that, Representative Story. Any further discussion on amendment number 6? Representative Hemshut.
Yeah, through the chair. I'm just curious how this even works at this point, because the department tracks, there are in-service requirements that are annual, some that are every 3 years, and the department tracks that, or at least the school district does. I'm not sure if it's the department or the district. And so to the extent practicable, I'm just not sure how this would even work. Actually, could I ask Ms. Manning?
Please.
Thanks. Through the chair, Ms. Manning, how does it work if you have something that says you shall require to the extent practicable? Does that mean that you make districts aware of it and then they choose whether they do it or not? Or how do you interpret what this now says?
Ms. Manning?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, this is Kelly Manning with the Department of Education and Early Development. I would have to look into more specifically how we track, how we would track if the language reads as stated. With our current courses that are required, we track based off of their certification. So when a certification is renewed, we look for those required courses. If it was to the extent practicable, I would have to confer with our team and get back to you so I can look into that.
Thank you, Chair. I just don't even know how this is going to work, but I think we'll go ahead and consider the amendment if that's okay.
Understood. Any further discussion on amendment number 6? All right. Hearing none, I will maintain my objection to amendment number 6. If you could please call the roll.
Representative Hemshute.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Crox.
No.
Representative McCormick.
Yes.
Representative McKay.
No.
Co-Chair Allard is absent.
No. No.
My vote is
no.
Sorry.
Brief at ease.
Chair Ruffridge, can I just withdraw the amendment?
Well,
do we have to vote now?
We will be back on record, and we are on amendment number 6. The original vote has been voided, and we will take up that vote again on amendment number 6. Please call the roll.
Representative McKay.
No.
Representative Hemshute.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Crox.
No.
Representative McCormick.
Yes.
Co-Chair Allard.
No.
Co-Chair Ruffridge.
No.
That's 3 yeas, 4 nays.
And so with a vote of 3 yeas and 4 nays, amendment number 6 will not be adopted. Moves us to amendment number 7. Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. I move amendment number 7.
And I will object for discussion.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. This amendment simply takes the burden of the expense of supplying this medication off of the districts and puts it squarely on the Department of Health, which of the 13 districts already...
Brief at ease. Okay, back on record, Representative Hemshute on amendment number 7.
So sorry, amendment number 7... limits the requirement to events that are only on school grounds. And if I could just give an example of why I think this is needed. You might hold a school event at a place like a public library, a spelling bee or something like that. And so if it's a school event off school grounds, without this amendment, it would be required that the school go to the event and make sure that the stuff is there. Regardless of where the event is held. So is a parade welcoming a championship team home, a school event, you know, the understanding of the application of the law as it's written right now, this legislation as it's written is tricky. And so this amendment seeks to just place it squarely on school grounds.
Thank you, Representative Hemshute. Representative Johnson, did you have any thing you wanted to add to this amendment at all?
I mean, I hear what the amendment maker is saying, and I think that it's depending on what the will of the committee is, then we can work with it.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Other comments or questions from committee members? Representative Story?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. My memory is the superintendents who testified at the first meeting spoke to the difficulty of having to do this for events. And that was their, they cautioned us
that this would be hard to do.
Thank you, Representative Story. Other comments or questions on amendment number 7, Representative McCormick?
Thank you, through the chair. Comments. First one, I can relate and understand why it might be difficult to enforce this. I think the example that Representative Himshute gave makes me think, like, what if, you know, they're doing a welcoming event at the airport for maybe state champions or something like that? Would that apply? But on the flip side, I guess I do just kind of feel like cost-benefit analysis, you know, it might be burdensome or difficult to enforce these overdose drugs being present. But, you know, if the event strikes where someone's having an overdose and it saves someone's life, then I think the burden of, you know, having it on your person is less than student losing their life. So that's kind of the dichotomy I think I have right now and would really like some more discussion on this amendment so I might be able to make a better decision on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McCormick. Any other discussion on amendment number 7?
I might just say one thing.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can see where this may, you know, whatever the practical reality of this might be, but I think one of the things that's important that I am hoping that this bill gets across and it, you know, whatever form that it gets into law as, is that these are drugs that are easily accessible, they're easily administered, and they should be in everyone's first aid kit. It shouldn't be have to be some special kind of, you know, even the box on the wall, she doesn't have to be that special, you know. It's something that we could have and it's easy to keep around. So anyway, I just want to make that
statement. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I think that's a point well taken. Other comments or questions on amendment number 7? All right, seeing none, I will maintain my objection and please call the roll.
Representative McCormick.
Yes.
Representative McCain.
No.
Representative Himshute.
Yes.
Representative Story.
No.
Representative Cross.
Yes.
Co-chair Allard.
No.
Co-chair Ruffridge.
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
So with a vote of 3 yeas and 4 nays, amendment number 7 will not be adopted. Brings us to amendment number 8, Representative Himshute.
Thank you. I move amendment number 8.
And I will object, Representative Himshute.
This is the one that puts the expense of the kits on the Department of Health. They confirmed they were serving 13 districts already, including some of the larger districts in the state. This would expand their role to providing these kits or allowing the districts to get the kits from, I'm saying kit, medication from the Department of Health directly to relieve the burden on districts. We hope the stuff is never used, but it is going to have to be replenished at an expiration date at some point. And if somebody needs it and takes it home with them out of the kit and it has to be replaced, I would like that expense not to fall on the districts at this time.
Thank you, Representative Himshute. Representative McKay.
Is there a fiscal note for how much this would cost for 54 school districts in, I don't know how many schools there actually are, 250 schools or whatever it is? Sounds like we got to have a fiscal note if it's going to be under the Department of Health.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Did you have any response to that, Representative Himshute?
Sure, Chair Ruffridge, it seems we would need a fiscal note regardless. Like, we heard $45 for two, and then there's 500-some schools, two kits per school. It's going to start to add up.
Thank you, Representative Himshute. Representative McKay.
I don't think you can require the school districts to have to provide a fiscal note. What they do with their money is their business. So the school districts don't need a fiscal note, but the State Department of Health would.
I actually had a question for the bill sponsor on this. We had mentioned in testimony the potential of using some of the opioid remediation funds to provide access. I'm concerned that this language may reduce that option. I didn't know if you had thoughts on that or not.
So just general thoughts on the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One is this bill does go to health. The health social services next, which I think would be a good opportunity to take up this issue in HESS. The fiscal note piece we're working on with the department and so on, I guarantee you when we get a fiscal note, it's going to pop up and it'll be clear what we're going to end up having to do with that. So, and then it will have, maybe have an additional referral to finance. So at this time, we're working on the fiscal piece, and I do expect, I'm anticipating working on, the fiscal piece. So as far as Department of Health versus the Department of Education, I think maybe my staff has a little bit more information, like the actual kits of things. First aid kits and so on are placed by the Department of Education or the school districts, through the department to the school districts. The actual maintenance of the medication and making sure, or maintenance of the kits, making sure. And I'm not talking about this kit. I'm talking about just the first aid kits and so on in general. That's maintained by the Department of Health through the public health. Nurses that come to the schools, and then they check to see if everything's there and available. So there is already kind of a bit of a partnership between both departments in first aid type equipment in the schools already.
Thank you for that. Other questions or discussion, Representative Story?
Thank you for that information. And that information leads me to think that it seems having the Department of Health supply, what words do we change it to? The current opioid, can't remember the, don't have my First Amendment in front of me, but it seems that it would be actually a way that the state would be taking the lead on this to the Department of Health. And we know school districts have many demands on their finances, and it seems appropriate that the Department of Health should be providing this medicine. It's not medicine, but.
Thank you, Representative Story. Other comments or questions, Representative McCormick?
Thank you. So I've articulated that I think it's imperative that this move as quickly as possible. So I do kind of have some pause in passing this amendment on the grounds that I think it'll get a finance referral. Nonetheless, just in communication I've had with school districts that I represent, whenever we have an unfunded mandate, often what happens is whatever it is that we're trying to accomplish as a state legislature, often smaller rural school districts who don't have a lot of money operate out of compliance. And so in that regard, I think it's important for us to ensure that the financial backing is in place so this program can be successful. I want this to move as fast as possible, but I also want it to work. And so I support this amendment. I think this is how we make this program possible. And if this is to pass, then I would suggest that perhaps we just remove the HESS referral. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McCormick. Other discussions or questions on amendment number 8? All right, seeing none, I will maintain my objection to amendment number 8. If you could please call the roll.
Representative Frost.
Yes.
Representative McCormick.
Yes.
Representative McCain.
No.
Representative Hemshoop.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Co-Chair Allard.
No.
Co-Chair Rutledge.
No.
That's 4 yeas, 3 nays.
So with a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, amendment number 8 will not be adopted.
Co-chair Ruffridge.
Representative Story.
Yes, I'd like...
Oh, what did I say? Oh, I apologize. I will go back. With 4 yeas and 3 nays, amendment number 8 has been adopted. I apologize, committee members. Representative Story.
Yes, I wanted to rescind action on number 7, amendment number 7.
Thank you, Representative Story. I will object.
Thank you. I just simply voted the way that I did not mean to vote, so I wanted the opportunity to re-vote that amendment again.
Understood. I will remove my objection. Is there any further objection to rescinding action on amendment number 7? Seeing none, amendment number 7 is back before us, and this is the deletion of language on page 1, line 12, 13, and page 2, line 5, regarding school-sponsored events. Is there any further discussion on amendment number 7? Representative McCormick, you're tricking me now, and I think you're having fun. All right, please call the roll on amendment number 7.
Representative Crox.
Yes.
Representative McCormick.
Yes.
Representative McKay.
No.
Representative Hinshue.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Co-chair Allard.
Absolutely not. No.
Co-chair Ruffridge.
No.
That's 4 yeas, 3 nays.
So with a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, amendment number 7 has been adopted. That brings us back to the bill at hand, House Bill 202, as amended. It is my intention to move this bill from committee today. Is there any objection to that from committee members? All right, seeing none, Co-Chair Allard, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. I motion to move HB 202, version Sierra, also referred to as 33LS00. Can we take a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. Back on record, Co-Chair Al.
Thank you. I'll just start from my motion to move HB 202, version Sierra, also referred to as 33LS0705S, be advanced from the committee as amended with individual recommendations and attach fiscal notes and authorize legislative legal to make technical and conforming changes as needed.
Thank you, Representative Allard. Is there any further discussion or objection? Seeing none, House Bill 202 will be advanced from committee. Please stick around to sign that paperwork. If there is no other items before the committee, we will be adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 10:05 a.m. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, April 17th at 8 a.m., and we are adjourned.